Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sangkhang namassami. We've been together for 24 hours. And considering what a radical change it is from normal life to meditation retreat, I think we're doing very well. The room is very silent, and so I think we're all worthy of praise for the efforts we're making. It's nice to be here, nice to practice with you. One of the things I mentioned on Sunday, last Sunday, and I'd just like to repeat that, is the idea of a teaching for reflection as opposed to a teaching of belief. Belief is not wrong, but a reflective teaching, and what I was saying, those of you who were here, bear with me. If I have a cut on my face, I want to see how big the cut is, what I need to do with it. I get a mirror, I look at the cut in my face, I see, I clean it up, I put a band-aid on. So the mirror helps me to see my face. A reflective teaching is like that. It's a teaching which is meant to help us to understand ourselves, to understand how consciousness works, to understand what is the source of suffering and what is the source of peace. Belief, dogma doesn't really do that. Belief is in the realm of positions and viewpoints, and that's one of the great stumbling blocks in Buddhism, where people can be very opinionated. They can have very clever arguments about Buddhism and can debate about it and so on. And that's more the realm of scholarship. Scholarship has its importance. So I'm just reading a book on the philological approach to Buddhism that the Venerables gave me, and that explains where the Pali language might have come from and how translation works and so on and so forth, which is interesting. But it doesn't really liberate me. It gives me a set of ideas, historical ideas, of how the Pali language might have evolved. Whereas a reflective teaching, and I'm personally, I've gained a lot of that from my own teachers. And so there's a kind of oral tradition, and this book was talking about the oral tradition of recitation, which exists and existed more before words were written down, but there's also an oral tradition of teacher to pupil, teacher to disciple, practitioner to practitioner, where we share questions and insights, and the teacher helps us to act like a mirror. And so I've been very fortunate. Ajahn Chah and Ajahn Sumedho and my peers have been very helpful and in mirroring some of my own stuff and helping me to understand Buddhism in that kind of reflective way. And so, say, this idea of reflection, like if I were to say to you or ask you a question, what's the rarest thing in the world? And I, what? And I said, let's say I were to say, a contented and grateful person. Okay, contented. Now that might make you feel guilty. Oh yeah, I'm not very content, I'm not very grateful, blah, blah, blah. Which wouldn't be a reflection, it would just be a sort of oppression, wouldn't it? Right? And that sometimes we take some of the ideas of Buddhism, they say kind of oppress us. Whereas reflection would be, say, when we have our meal, we do a chant, Patisankha, Yoniso, etc., which is wisely reflecting. I use alms food, not for fun, not for pleasure, not for fattening, not for beautification, only for the maintenance and nourishment of this body, for keeping it healthy, for helping with the holy life. So it's a kind of a reflective exercise that we do before we eat. Now, then, as we look at our food, then we try to contemplate. So, what is happening in consciousness now when I see and smell this food and I'm about to eat? And if what is happening is discontent, I want more, I want different, I want salty, I want veg, I want meat, I want ice cream, I don't want this, then the reflection is a mirror, that reflection, patisanka, is a mirror which helps me to see my particular state of mind. And I usually, and if I use the mirrors that the Buddha is offering me, then what he's saying is contentment with little is a foundation for liberation, a foundation for peace, and a foundation for enlightenment. That's my training. That's the training I undertake. And I can see that's pretty obvious. If I'm content with little, Nietzsche had one, blessed be a moderate poverty, for he who possesses little is so much the less possessed. Moderate poverty. So when I'm practicing contentment with little as a reflection, then when I'm not content with little, I observe that state of mind. Oh, this is what it feels like to be discontent. And not to feel guilty about it, but also to see that's not the path to freedom. That's not the path to happiness. That's the path to suffering. But it's a reflection rather than a demand. The demand would be, you should be grateful. You're a Dhamma, these lay people have worked very hard, and you should just be grateful and shut up and accept your alms food. Or I could then just feel guilty because I don't feel grateful. So I put that upon myself. I think, oh, I should be more grateful. And then I try to really be grateful in a kind of false way. But the awakening of consciousness is different. It's taking what is, but really knowing what is, and then seeing, is this skillful? If I pursue this, will it give a skillful result? If it is unskillful, if I pursue it, will it give it an unskillful result? That I can see and watch and know. But I need to awaken. I need to awaken. So that's what a reflective, contemplative idea around Buddhism is about. I had a really uncomfortable experience. I was visiting Sri Lanka, and I had a dana, and I used the word nirodha in a rather unconventional way. And the word nirodha means cessation. I'm not a Pali scholar, and there was a woman there whose husband was a Pali scholar, and she went for my jugular. She just harangued me for about 10 minutes on this word. I said, "Whoa, lady, it's only a word." But she wouldn't have that either, so she harangued me for another 10 minutes. And it was really, really unpleasant. And I could see that she had strong ideas, and she had strong viewpoint, and certainly she was much more clever than I, but she had no compassion. Zero compassion and minimal wisdom, I think, too. So cleverness is not wisdom. Cleverness, people can be very clever, but also suffer a lot. And you could see how her energy, the people who were offering the dana were very embarrassed. And I was pretty antsy myself. Well, what did I do? Just feed me. And so from that kind of opinionated position, this person was very divisive. Very divisive, very, very unkind. But I don't think this person saw it. They just felt self-righteous and justified and so on. But if a person is using a reflective approach to Buddhism, so then say, for instance, in this case, you have the precept on right speech. I intake to speak correctly, and correctly is to not lie, not swear, not indulge in divisive gossip, and not speak stupidly, or to speak truthfully, to speak beautifully, to speak in concord. Now, if that person had taken the precepts in the morning, but had actually reflected on them, right speech, and then when she launched forth into her harangue, and saw, well, is this concord? Is this beautiful? Does it create harmony in culture and society? She would have seen, oh, wow, where's this coming from? And maybe she would say, well, this is coming from some kind of conceit, some kind of arrogance, some kind of aversion, or whatever it was. The root of it is unwholesome, unskillful. not from compassion, not from metta karuna. But so the trouble with some of Buddhist teaching, it's so clever that it easily falls into dogmatics, which is the place of scholarship. That's fine. Now, the way I was taught by Ajahn Chah, Ajahn Sumedho, Ajahn Chah told me, don't read for 5 years. I couldn't do it. I had to read. But he said, read the heart. Read the citta. Understand the citta. Even Thai. He didn't even emphasize learning Thai. He said, understand your heart. Read the heart. And so his constant refrain was to awaken to the way things are. Puto, the use of puru. The idea of being awake and knowing the way things are. And that's a reflective teaching. Huh? You see the difference. It's very important, very important. Because if you leave Buddhism at as an idea level, you always go back to doubt. The classic one is when people ask us, so what happens when you die? Right? What happens in the last mind moment? Or how does rebirth take place? And does it take place? And so on. That's just thought. That's just thought. But what you can know for sure is that's a doubt. Now that's reflection. No, doubt feels this way. Now, a person who doesn't see doubt as a kind of natural condition of mind and always wants to have an intellectual answer, then goes around asking every monk in the world the same question. And I ask people, they ask me that, so how does rebirth work? I said, how many times have you asked this question? Well, the last 20 years, quite a few. And have you ever got an answer where you didn't doubt afterwards? No. So why do you keep asking? Well, I don't know. And that's the sort of desire to know, which is okay. But as I was saying on Sunday night, when you can see doubt arise and cease, and in the ceasing there is the silence of no thought, that's the end of doubt. You may doubt again, that's fine. And the doubt may be very useful. How many are coming for lunch? Cook needs to know. Are the Sri Lankans coming at 10:30 or 11:30? That's an important doubt. Was I a rabbit in a past life? Don't know. Don't know. Or whatever. So doubt is a natural condition, but when you're reflecting on the conditioned nature of consciousness, then doubt arises and ceases. Sometimes there's an answer, sometimes there's not an answer. But the knowing, that which knows doubt, is non-doubt. Now keep coming back to that. That which knows doubt is non-doubt. The feeling of not knowing is this way. But the knowing of not knowing is what? It's just silence, just that. And that's where you find the end of doubt. Which doesn't mean that you don't doubt. I'm spinning around here, but you see what I mean? So intellect is useful, okay? Intellect is useful, but it's limited. It's limited. So how do we then use intellect in a skillful, reflective way rather than always just being caught in intellectual positions? Sometimes we get like young monks coming to the monastery. And, you know, they've read 2 suttas, right? And they know everything. How we should run the monastery, how to do the Vinaya. You know, we've been training for years and years and years and years. And this young guy comes and tells us how to do it. Okay. Yeah. And they're so kind of sincere in their knowledge. But they haven't got a clue. I mean, your kids must do that, right? Mark Twain had that one where he said, I was very disappointed in my father's intelligence when I was 15. But when I became 19, I was impressed at how much he had grown. So conceit and attachment to views is a huge hindrance. It really is. It really blocks. It blocks the heart and keeps us caught in the realm of intellect. So how do you use intellect as a reflective tool rather than simply being opinionated and stuck at a dogmatic level? So one of the things I wanted to on the think you were given a schedule, and I think there was a teaching on the back of the schedule. And I wanted to just use that as a kind of theme for the reflection of this retreat. And it's a restatement by a Thai teacher who is contemporary to Lompo Cha, Ajahn Chah, Lompo Dun. Is it Dun or Dun? Dun, Lompo Dun. And I actually named the monk that we ordained at Tisarna after his Pali name, which is Atulo, because I do like his teaching. Now this is, I'll read it out for those who didn't bring this. This is a restatement of the Four Noble Truths. So I guess we should go through that sometime. But so on the Four Noble Truths, a senior monk of the meditation tradition came to pay his respects to Lompu. Lompu is venerable grandfather. Lompo is venerable father. Lompi is venerable brother. In Thai, they have these beautiful honorifics because they really honor their elders. It's really lovely, very touching, how they pay respect to the elders in their culture. On the first day of the Rains Retreat in 1956, after giving him instruction, a number of teachings on profound matters, Lompu summarized the Four Noble Truths as follows. So it's a bit of it's a different structure for those of you who are used to the Four Noble Truths. So it's in four statements. The mind sent outside is the origination of suffering. The mind sent outside is the origination of suffering. The result of the mind sent outside is suffering. So that's a pair. The mind sent outside is the origination of suffering. The result of the mind sent outside is suffering. Second pair. The mind seeing the mind is the path. The result of the mind seeing the mind is the cessation of suffering. The mind seeing the mind is the path. The result of the mind seeing the mind is the cessation of suffering. So I'll try to unpack that. It's a nice challenge. In teaching, I kind of enjoy giving myself a little challenge. So you're the guinea pigs. But the Four Noble Truths are usually, if those of you who've studied Four Noble Truths, if you haven't, it's high time you did. There is suffering, there's a cause of suffering, there's a cessation of suffering, and there's the path which leads to the cessation of suffering. Suffering, dukkha, has a broad range of meanings. It can be discontent, it can be trauma, it can be all kinds of things. So anything where the heart feels a lack or discontent, we could say is suffering. So there's suffering. The cause of suffering is attachment to desire, attachment to craving. That's a huge issue. Craving, tanha, attachment to craving is the cause. The cessation of suffering, there's an end. The cessation of suffering can be realized, and it's the end of that craving, the end of wanting. And that has to be explained too. And the path goes from right understanding, etc., right thought, and right living, and so on. And this is stated differently. The mind sent outside is the origination of suffering. So he equates the second noble truth, he does that first, the mind sent outside is the origination of suffering. So maybe we look at that. What is outside? Well, outside is all objects in Buddhism. Outside isn't like out there in the foyer. Outside is any object of consciousness. So bodily feeling is an object. Well, let's say I'm sitting in meditation, as I was saying earlier, and my thigh starts to hurt. Thigh starts to hurt. And there's 20 minutes left. And my mind starts to think about these 20 minutes. I start to get restless. I look at the clock. I start to think, should I move or should I not move? A sense of I gets born into this. Me, time, future, restlessness. Now that, for me, would be the mind sent outside. The mind is now caught up with this physical discomfort. And I'm thinking about it and getting restless. So because my mind goes out, into this discomfort, into this pain, then I have the second one, the result of the mind sent outside is suffering. It's not just discomfort, it's all that extra that's going on. Let's say, sorry about the voice, let's say you were unfortunate to have a terrible divorce 10 years ago. I never had a divorce, so I don't know how it works, but I've heard about it. Okay, you had a terrible divorce, and it was really, really quite acrimonious and cost you a lot of money and quite awful, a lot, and you felt betrayed, etc., etc., etc. And then 10 years down the road, you go to a party, and you meet someone who starts praising your ex. Right? And they say, oh, what a wonderful person that person is. And your first feeling is murderous. You don't know who he is, and you know what he did to me. So, memory comes up into consciousness. Memory comes up into consciousness. Right? The mind sent outside is the origination of suffering. That's just a memory. But it's a powerful memory. And so the mind goes, your attention goes into the memory. I was unfair. How could they say they don't really know this person? That's a mind sent outside. The mind sent outside is suffering. So the memory comes up and attention gets caught up into that. A sense of self gets born. You're outside. Yeah? And that is suffering. The mind sent outside is the origination of suffering. So the origin is the mind goes out to it. The result of the mind sent outside is suffering. The second two, the mind seeing the mind is the path. The result of the mind seeing the mind is the cessation of suffering. So, you go to another party, right? And you just suffered through four meditations of this or whatever, or you think, oh, I thought I got through this. You go to another party and the same trigger gets pressed and the same memory comes up, but now you say, oh, memory feels this way. It feels this way. It still has emotional power. It still wants to create a sense of thought and self, but you stay with awareness. Memory feels this way. Wow, this is really strong. Yeah, it feels this way. You don't get caught by it. You don't go out to it. The mind, seeing the mind, is the path. That's the path. The result of the mind seeing the mind is the cessation of suffering. So it's cessation of suffering in various ways you can think of that. For one, you don't recreate that whole thing. You bear witness to it. It's still unpleasant. It's still unpleasant, but you don't recreate a sense of self through that. And then you bear with the unpleasantness with that particular memory, because you're just aware of it, that energy of suffering, which is that memory and the betrayal feelings and so on and so forth, that now isn't fed. You don't feed that because you don't go out to it, you know it. And because that's not fed, that also dies. And the karmic resultant of that awful situation, that whole memory pattern, memory trace, becomes less and less suffering for you. Less and less unpleasant. Less and less unpleasant. the pain in the hip. Is this working? Are you getting what I mean? The pain in the hip. pain starts, and you notice it right when it starts. Right there. You're right with it. You're mindful. And you see the mind wanting to do something about it. Craving, right? But now, so the mind seeing the mind is the path. So now you're noticing what the mind is doing around this pain. You're just with it. You're aware of pain feels this way. And you're seeing the attempt to look at the clock or do something. Oh, it's just this way. It's just this way. And you don't buy into that. And you begin to be at peace with discomfort. The result of the mind seeing the mind is the cessation of suffering. That makes sense? When we go out, how do we go out? We go take a fantasy. Let's say someone's offered you a Kindle. Actually, I just got given a Kindle. So, right? And so someone says, would you like a Kindle? And you, I don't know. And then Kindle comes up into consciousness. And someone praises it and says, wow, it's a really neat, neat bit of kit, man. And that's an image. But the mind goes out into the image and thinks, oh yeah, that'd be really nice. And then I could get this book, and then I could get this, and then I could get that app. Yeah, nice casework would be good. Mm-hmm. The mind goes out, right? So the mind sent outside is the origination of suffering. Huh? The mind goes out into that possibility of future. The result of the mind sent outside is suffering. That's suffering. You're not present. It might be entertaining for a while, but anyone who's meditated, do that for a day and then you'll have it for a week. You won't be able to get rid of the Kindle. It'll plague you. Then you notice that, you know, oh, greed feels this way. Or fantasy feels this way, and you feel that. The mind, seeing the mind is the path. That's the path. You see the mind as the mind. You just see, this is what the mind's doing. The result of the mind, seeing the mind as cessation of suffering, that whole disturbance of mind ceases. So this you have to apply to consciousness and see in your own life, how does your mind go out? And the way you can see how the mind goes out is by feeling what it's like to be home. And that's what one idea around samadhi is, that in meditation, what you're doing is you're learning to come home. Yeah? You're learning to, like, just be here. Like Ram Dass, it still works, be here now. Just be here. This feels this way. Non-becoming. So this language, non-becoming. Not going anywhere. Not rejecting. Receptive. This is a kind of language that really works very well for me. So then you establish what it means to be present and at home. And then you try to make that basis of presence stronger and stronger. And this is one way of looking at samadhi. That the capacity to be present, to be aware of the way things are, becomes stronger and stronger. So then when there is that sense of strong presence, then when the mind goes out, you see, that's the cause. That's the cause. So the cause of suffering is not the discomfort. Discomfort is natural. And so we have to look at the word suffering. And suffering in this sense, we have the word dukkha. And dukkha can mean unpleasant. But the unpleasant in this sense is not suffering. The unpleasant becomes suffering when I get caught up with it. Now, what do you mean by that? Well, all of us, I think, have experienced discomfort. Yeah, discomfort. And it's not suffering. It's just discomfort. When does it become suffering? When there's the anticipation and the grasping and the going out into it. I think all of us have seen that. You must have seen that in meditation, where you can feel something quite uncomfortable and be peaceful. And you can feel something uncomfortable and not be peaceful. So it's not the pleasant or the unpleasant. Now, if Buddhist practice was based upon always getting the pleasant, you're finished, aren't you? That's impossible, right? Physically, emotionally, in the sense realm, a constant experience of comfort is not possible. So obviously, if we're going to be free, somehow we have to understand discomfort and lack and loneliness and fear. All these things are a part of the human condition. So fear is not suffering if the mind knows the mind. Now you'd think fear is suffering. No, fear in this sense is unpleasant. When does fear become suffering? When we grasp the fear and we run with it with self-thoughts. So why I talk about fear is because that's been one of my great teachers, is I just karmically, I have had to work with tremendous amounts of fear and panic attacks and all kinds of interesting energies around that. And I don't know why. I had good parents, and so I can't figure it out in any kind of logical way. So I just reckon it's some kind of karmic baggage, which is my teacher. And so I found that, like understanding, to understand fear was quite difficult, because my first impulse was to try to get rid of fear, because it was so unpleasant. And so that never really worked, because what I was doing, I was going out into the fear and arguing with it. See, you know, I'll give you compassion if you drop dead. That's my sort of basic argument. Or I would do fierce things to try to get rid of it or whatever. And it was only when I began to see, oh, fear feels this way, coming back, not going out into it, but allowing it to be and being receptive to fear. Fear feels this way, mind knowing the mind, that I began to see that the suffering is not the fear, but it's the grasping of the fear that was the problem. It took a long time to understand that. It took a long time through just experimenting. And basically my teachers always telling me, everyone around me knew the problem, but my fear of fear, my desire to get rid of the fear was so blinding. And that's natural, isn't it? This is what ignorance is about. Ignorance blinds. And so some of the things we face are we're blinking. But through the kind of struggle, well, this is definitely suffering. I'm really feeling this. And the way I learned this was through giving talks. This is a great, if you want to experience fear, give talks. Most people feel nervous. Some monks don't, but I felt very nervous. And so that became my practice of knowing the feeling of fear before giving a Dhamma talk. We often talk about this because we only have a few examples in this life anyway. So then I would prepare a talk. I prepare it, I really kind of get a really brilliant talk going. You know how you can prepare things? And so I'd rehearse it, and then I'd go blank. And I'd really just go blank. I'd forget completely this brilliant talk I just had. Very embarrassing. So I saw, well, I wasn't looking at the fear. I was just trying to repress it with this rehearsed kind of talk. So that didn't work. And then I just began to just do body awareness. I said, well, where is fear in the body? And then it was definitely here and here. It's in the throat, through the front of the body, through the belly. And I began to just allow the fear to be as it was before a talk. And that was very difficult, right? Because it's an odd thing about giving talks is you're with friends and you're still going to get fed tomorrow, but you feel, I guess it's kind of performance anxiety or something like that, I don't know what it is. But anyway, it was very real. And yet, I could go in Thailand, like I remember one of the teachers I stayed with, Lompo Si, he was, his father had died, and they placed his coffin on kind of high stilts in the forest for contemplation. And I know in Thailand they have a lot of fear of ghosts. So I thought, oh, I'd love to see a ghost. So I went to the forest and sat underneath, and I didn't see a ghost, and I wasn't afraid, and I fell asleep. So fear manifested in different ways for me. For someone maybe with a Thai conditioning around ghosts, it's different. But so wherever the fear manifests doesn't really matter. So the manifestation of fear, then I saw that the problem was going out into the fear, trying to get rid of it, worry. You take worry, let's say. You have some, let's say you get a phone call and there's something unpleasant going on at work or in the family, and you're going to have to face it when you go leave the retreat. And so, and the possibilities are complex, and you know, it's going to be complicated, and you know the people involved, and you're not looking forward to it, and actually you're afraid. Huh? So what happens? And you come into the meditation, you've had that phone call, you wish you'd never had that phone call, should have given the SIM card, but anyway, here it is. Here it is. And what comes up into consciousness is dread. Dread comes up into consciousness. Now, if you're really the mind knowing the mind, then you're right with it. You think dread feels this way. And where does it feel this way? In the guts or whatever? And it's very, very unpleasant. It's very unpleasant. So rather than bear witness to the unpleasant, rather than see the cessation of the unpleasant, you go to what you think is pleasant. And where do you go? You go to worry. Because worry is more pleasant than this awful knot in your stomach. So then you worry. And you worry in what way? You think through You do, like I did for the talk, you rehearse it. Then I'll say this, and then I'll say that, and then I'll say this, and then I'll say that. And that makes you feel good, because somehow you think you've solved the problem. And then you relax, and then the, and it comes up in your gut again. Yes, but what if? Right? And then you think, but then I'll do this, and then I'll do that. And you continually worry. You continually worry. Why? Because your mind goes out into the fear and becomes involved with it through all kinds of self-views and thoughts and so on. And that's worry. So there's the pleasant, the unpleasant, pleasant, unpleasant. And then one day you see it's not the problem out there. It's the very energy of worry or the very energy of fear or anger, whatever. That's what I have to understand. Because the triggers for this are infinite. The infinite possibilities for dread and anxiety and worry and fear. They're all over the place. So then I say, okay. Now I'm looking at the mind rather than my social situation. I'm still going to have to deal with that now. Where is fear? How does it feel? And that's the beginning of freedom of fear. So then, the practice is bearing witness to the unpleasant. And the lesson you get with discomfort in the meditation is the lesson you take to the more difficult mind states that you face. So then I've learned how to be peaceful with discomfort in the hip. I've learned that lesson intuitively, not intellectually, intuitively, because I've actually been doing it. That's the craft. So then that when this karma, say, in my example, the fear comes up, then there is already a kind of attunement to practice, a skill in practice. Practice. I've done the practice. And that clicks into place. And then there's a kind of capacity I've built up through little ways, little things, and I begin to know fear is fear. And I have the patience and endurance and determination to know it just as it is. It's just this way. Because I know everything else doesn't work. Now then it starts to go through me, and it almost seems like it's worse than it was. This is worse. And so I have to do something about it. I have to do something. No, it just feels this way. And this is where you need faith and trust. What do you trust in? Do you trust in that self-thought, or you trust in it feels just this way? So the suggestion is trust in that, trust in awareness, trust in knowing change. And this is where the reflective teaching comes in. This too will change. Now, when you bring that in, this will change. You have this perspective of Buddha knowing Dharma. If the ideas of change are simply a philosophical position you've taken in Buddhism, you'll forget to do it. But if you have this kind of reflective mind, as it comes up, you also say, "And how does the changing feel? Or this will change. This isn't permanent." And you bring that perspective to know this now as an object in consciousness rather than you. You have the distance of perspective. You're objective. If you're not objective, your mind goes out there. What am I going to do? And what am I going to say? And it's going to da 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 da. So this is the reflective capacity. You bring in the dark. This is not self. Not me, not mine. Now when you say that, if you believe that, then it's just a kind of idea. But if you actually use it in the moment, so the fear comes up, not me, not mine, that gives you distance because the attachment, me and mine, what am I going to do? And you say, not me, this is changing. All of a sudden you have perspective, you're aware. And that's what these teachings are trying to do. They're trying to awaken you in this dharmic perspective. So then the fear now, the fear, and I can just share my own example, is then the fear would come up and witness it. Come up, witness it. Come up, witness it. A million times. And slowly the karma of fear, that unpleasantness, fades away and fear is no longer a major factor in consciousness. If it comes up again, fine. So there's two things going on. There's the awakening to it and then there's the purification. It goes through you in this kind of purifying way. And that you just have to wait out. How long it'll last? Beats me, don't know. But what else is there to do? However long it takes, do it. This is the idea. If you want to meditate, meditate. If you don't want to meditate, meditate. If you want to feel fear, fine. If you don't want to feel fear, fine. Feel it. So this is where you need courage, you need determination, and you need to go beyond self-view. If you get caught up in a kind of endless self-analysis, why am I feeling this fear, and maybe it was this in my childhood and so on, that self-analysis might give you some kind of insight, but it'll still be fear. So the idea in Buddhism is Don't take it personally. Don't take your life personally. This is fear. It feels this way. Certainly it's personal. It's, you know, I feel this fear. You don't feel this fear. But take it personally in Buddhism, you mean this is a grasping going out into it. So, for, you know, I can just testify to this. It does work. I mean, I feel really good. But I had one experience in Auckland, which was this was many, many years ago. It must have been 15 years ago more. Oh no, it was kind of 1990, I guess. Anyway, 87. My father had died. I'd been with my father, and I had to go to an ecumenical meeting in Auckland, in the big cathedral in Auckland, and I had to give the Buddhist peace. I'd give a 5-minute peace, and it was very good because I was quite enlivened with this experience with my father, so there's a really kind of sincere thing. People were impressed. They said, would you please give the keynote address next year? I said, sure. Big mistake. So the next year, okay, it's 200-300, a lot of people, ecumenical. It's a peace meeting, right? And I have a panic attack. Not now. It's incredible. You know, like, I thought I worked this through. And that will happen sometimes, you know. You think, oh gosh, I thought I worked this through. Don't take it personally. There's no one working through anything. It's just karma coming through. So there I am. I have to give this talk, and I'm really shaken. I really am. You know? So I was staying with Lama Sumpton in outside Auckland in a Tibetan monastery. And I get up and I give this talk. And I don't know about you, sometimes when you're afraid, you give an anger talk. So here I am. It's a peace meeting, and I give this angry talk. So then, not only is there the fear, then there's the embarrassment, and then, of course, the self-disparagement, right? And the whole schlamazel. So then I'm going back to Lama Sumpton's monastery and in his car, and he sort of, in his Asian, beautiful, delicate way, says, you know, Buddhism's about peace. But so my mind wanted to go to self-disparagement, because that's what my mind easily does. And I just really had to work with that. No, this is what it feels like to feel embarrassed. This is memory. Keep coming back to that. So the mind then, so the feeling of embarrassment was very unpleasant too, obviously. And so then that comes up. Now we don't want to be with the unpleasant, do we? And that's where the craving comes up. We don't want the unpleasant, so we seek the pleasant. So the unpleasant memory comes up. Oh, God, how could I blow that out? This is what unpleasant memory feels like. And I wanted to escape, and we want to escape into thought. And it's interesting how self-disparagement can be escape from this kind of pain. It's more pleasant to hate yourself than feel that. It's an odd situation because it's in thought. Whereas this is in the guts. This is in the heart. So then the mind wants to go there. No, it feels this way. And that's the idea of the mind going out. So then there's the karmic result of this. It comes up into consciousness. No. Self-disparagement feels this way. Constantly, this is what you're doing. You're coming back to that. The mind knowing the mind. The result, that's the path. The result is the cessation of suffering in a myriad of ways. Now, this is something that you don't become this, do you? It's not like an attainment. It's a remembering of the path. It's a practice. It's a cultivation of practice. So in any areas where you find your mind is really, really rabid, really thinking a lot, and there's a strong sense of self going on, there's also a strong feeling behind that. It has to be. And so if something triggers in you some really strong self-views and thoughts, and then just wake up and say, wow, where's that? Where's that in the body? It feels this way. Don't try to get rid of it, but honor it, recognize it, let it come through you, and let that purification take place. Because then you begin to have the peace which is unconditioned. It's not dependent on who you're with, where you are, and so on. It's free from these kind of defilements and outpourings. So it's an arduous path in that way. You know, it's not that straightforward. It takes a lot of courage to do it. But it's not a demand that you be, you know, Buddhism isn't a demand that you be a nice person. That's the beauty of it. You can be absolutely rotten, practice right speech, practice the precepts, don't dump your stuff for anybody, but just know, oh, this is what it feels like to be rotten. And then you're not that. You're not that. It's just a mood that comes through consciousness. And you begin to see that that which knows fear is non-fear. You begin to realize that more and more. So I think that's more than enough. I'll end for your reflection there. Sadhu.